Welcome to the Locate 852 podcast, bringing you insights on how you can build and scale your business with social platforms. Hosted by the leading Facebook ad strategist in Hong Kong, entrepreneur, branding expert, and the founder of Locate 852, Chris Chung.
Buddy, I appreciate you being on the show. How have you been?
I've been good, thanks. And thanks so much for having me. It's an honor, but also because we're friends as well, it makes it even more special.
It makes these things 10 times easier. Sometimes when I'm preparing for these shows, it gets you, it's like, wow, this person's accomplished so much in such a short period of time. And you're trying to gather everything. You want to make sure you ask the right questions and you have to packet everything together, but also make it light and not so serious. But it's always good to have a friend on the show. You have accomplished so much at such a young age, from, you know, Burberry, Estee Lauder, Dior, to also the campaign that we met and became friends on. Now you're a founder of an agency that we're potentially being able to collaborate on together as well. Fable and Main, Forbes, the list goes on. But take us all the way back to the beginning, to young Akash. How did you grow up and what was your upbringing like?
Oh, no, too kind. So I was born in London of Indian parents. My mom is from India, born in Indian Pune. My dad is from Africa, but he's of Indian origin in Uganda. And they met in London. So me and my sister, we were born in London, close to North London. So grew up here, went to the same school for 11 years. And was in quite a little bubble, I guess, of kind of North London community. And then it was in university where I think I really kind of found myself and flourished, because I got exposed to a lot of different types of people and I guess you could say, and different hobbies. So growing up, my main hobbies were just studying. So that's a hobby in a way. So all I remember my childhood was just a lot of studying and a lot of music. So I did piano, violin for like 11, 12 years. So music and studying was my thing. And then I went to university and studied engineering. So I did 4 years of that because I loved math. I loved physics. As a very typical Indian kid, I followed the path that, honestly, my parents are the most chill parents. They didn't even like say, you know, you got to be an engineer, you got to be a doctor. I just chose that life upon me. But I loved it. But I think it was during my university time, I also pursued music. I continued it, but more on the singing route. I actually had a bit of a wake-up call in my second year. And you know, at that time, it was really difficult to talk about. But now I very openly talk about it, because it was like, if I wasn't for that, I wouldn't be where I am today. I failed my second year. And this is coming from, you know, clearly when I say my childhood was mainly studying, you can imagine I was a very much a grades exam person. So, you know, when I got less than 95% in an exam, it would be like upsetting for me, right? So this is me as a kid. So when I'm at university failing and having to, like, you know, in second year deciding, do I drop out? What do I do? And all my friends continuing. That was a big wake up call. And I think that's when I go back to where I really found myself in university. I realized there's more to life than just grades. There's more to life than just studying. You got to do what you enjoy in life. And you got to do what finds, you know, what makes you, what makes you happy. And that's often stemming from where you find passion in. So it was a wake up call to realize life, you know, it really doesn't stop at university with your degree. It kind of starts and you can do whatever you want. Even if you did engineering, you could find a career in a complete different path. So I kind of took that year out. I worked in Burberry. I did an internship in digital marketing. It's what I found at the time. I fell in love with marketing and the idea of brand building, especially through the rising channel that was digital at the time and social media. This was in 2013, 14. So, you know, this was quite new on social media. Instagram was just rising for brands. And I actually went back to university, finished my degree and said, okay, now in life, you do what makes you happy, what you find passionate in. Don't do what, you know, people think you should do, or what your university says you should do. And that was a big wake up call.
How did you go from studying engineering to doing music to then deciding to go into Burberry? And what was that? What was that connection like for you?
So I think it was, not necessarily. So the accident was just finding the internship in digital marketing, which was the only one available, and a connection through a connection. And yeah, the accidental mistake of, actually, this is super cool, I think I could be good at it. But I think my acceleration into digital and why I think I excelled in it was a twofold approach. One is, it was, okay, threefold. A, it was new at the time. So it was not necessarily something that a lot of young entrepreneurs, young people would be entering the work field doing, even though, you know, the younger ones were usually the ones living on Instagram every day, were the ones posting, understanding the algorithm. I think that tethered with the fact that I was a singer, trying to grow my own social media following when I was kind of working with record labels at the time. It was very understood, like, if you wanted to get signed and you wanted to tour around, then you need to start growing your own social media. So while I was writing and also doing covers of songs, I would kind of craft my own Akash Mehta as a musician, as a business, and understand all about, like, even search terms, SEO, ads, how to get more streams, how to get more followers organically paid. So I think I grew my social media following. I had, I think at the time, a couple of, maybe like 100,000 followers. I had a million plays on Spotify. I had some viral moments. So I kind of realized, wait, if I translate this into business and change the kind of, I guess you could say, the subject from Akash Mehta to the brand, it's a lot of transferable skills in growth marketing, digital marketing, social media. So that was pretty, I guess, the one USP. And the second USP, I think, is in that time, while there were some people entering the market as social media experts, I came in with that very mathematical, analytical approach. So there was a lot of kind of PR roles, a lot of like awareness, and this is social media and it's growth. But I always came in with an extra inkling of like, okay, this is all great, but this is a very gray market. You know, gray area, not gray market, but gray area industry where people didn't really know the ROI of social media, of influencers. Is it really resulting in sales? And my job was like, well, I want to put some numbers to this. I want to put some data to this, some capturing it in an Excel. So I think the trio of being quite new, having my own digital presence at the time, and being one of the first like micro influencers to enter the work field and not be an influencer at that time. Yeah. And then the analytical part, I think, helped.
So did you take time off school in order to pursue that internship, or how did that work?
Yeah, well, because I failed that year, I had to retake just the exams because my coursework and stuff were fine. So because I had to wait a year to redo those 12 exams, and there was 12 exams, 12 3-hour exams, it was a nightmare. To redo that, I didn't want to like spend the year studying fully all the time again, because I already like did all the coursework, knew all the stuff. I just had to maybe spend 3-4 months before the exams really studying for them. So in that time, I did a 6-month internship to not kind of lose my focus. I didn't want to travel. I didn't want to do any of that. I just wanted to work and make that year productive to my future.
And how was your experience then working interning at Burberry? Like, what was it? Was it scary? Was it hard? Was it challenging?
It was amazing because I think at that age, I was definitely one of the youngest interns ever. And
how old were you?
I think I was 19. While they had work experience students, and being a kind of a 6-month placement intern actually was an investment on their end and for me as well. Like, so I got to go to all the meetings, meet all the agencies. I was working in a team which was bought media, which was, I guess, out of home paid media. So working a lot with banners and billboards. And while it wouldn't be like my favorite thing to do now, at that time, it's the first thing I got exposed to in digital, and I loved it. I thought it was so interesting. I also found it in a little way, it was a lot more, easier and simpler than engineering. So, you know, going from NPM, PNP, resistors and transistors, and working with all these different I was coding every day. So it was Verilog or MATLAB and all this stuff, to then suddenly being like, oh, we're going to do this billboard in Terminal 5 Heathrow and it's going to cost this. Should we go? What's the asset size? It was a lot simpler. And I think for me, I was happier because I could excel a lot more in it than kind of catching up in engineering. So yeah, it was good, because obviously the hard part after was, do I continue? Do I just leave university and just work now? But I think because I did a year and then obviously I naturally just did the exams again and passed, then I was initially in a master's course of 4 years. So I just said, you know what, just go to a bachelor's, do 3 years, just have one more year of just finishing this degree that you set out to do. Yeah. Went back, did that one extra year, and then boom, I graduated. And you know, the craziest thing is at that time, it was so embarrassing because to myself, because all my friends continued on a year later. I just felt like, oh God, I was at Imperial College, one of the best universities in the world. And yeah, the professors, they're probably embarrassed about me because I failed. I just felt really like, I didn't feel at home. And then a few years later, which, you know, we can talk about the success I had in during owning these companies. I then got asked to by Imperial to be one of their notable alumni. So if you, and had a whole interview. And so if you go on their website and you go in like the very few notable alumni they talk about, it was me. And I'm like, do they even know I failed? Do they, like, they think they knew really well now as opposed to alumni. But like, I'm like, do they even know how bad I was when I was there? But I think in a way that's hopefully quite encouraging to people because, you know, you can still fail and go back, graduate and be recognized. You know, it doesn't mean it's the end. It could be actually a better opportunity.
I'm sure that's such a good feeling going back to Imperial and getting that notable, just because the way that I grew up was sort of similar, but I was horrible at academics. It was never my thing, but I always knew entrepreneurship was kind of my path. And then further down the line, I got to go back to school and then have talks similar to what you did. So I can fully relate to on that front. But going back to what you were saying, you were already picking up traction as an artist with your music, and you grew 100,000 followers, you had 1 million streams. What made you go from, why didn't you double down on that since there was already traction compared to, you know, taking a slightly separate path?
That's a very good question. So, you know, to be honest, it was, again, I had this whole accidental mistake. Like I, as a human being, I think you have to always remember who you are first as a soul, as you, you know, and usually tethers to like who you are growing up. It's usually a form of who you are because we get a lot of experiences in our kind of adulthood and or even teenhood, and then it changes you a bit. But I think always I was a very private kind of quiet, humble kind of kid. I was always the quietest in the room. I was that kid when if people came in said, do you want one, or like is a platter of food, I'd be like, no, I'm okay, even though I really wanted it. I just always would resort to no, I'm okay. And I would never want to be the center of attention. Like I never I sang a lot in university because I started busking, got confidence up, but in school I never entered any of my talent shows. I never went on stage. I never was in main role because I was like, I don't want to be in the attention of the, you know, in the limelight. So I think social media was an amazing thing that happened to me from my music because it allowed me to get more confident in myself. It allowed me to understand that actually having a lot of love by people and respect and getting just a lot of online at that time, you know, kind of buzz around you, it's cool. Like it does have a lot of value, and it does also bring opportunities and brings you to meet amazing people. But I didn't want to get carried away by this vortex of social media where it's like, it's all about, okay, I've got 100,000, I need to get 1 million followers. And I started thinking like that, like, oh, I want to get now 1 million. And I think that wasn't healthy to my mental health. And I kind of said, like, if this happens as a byproduct of anything I do that makes mm-hmm. me passionate, that I'm passionate about and I'm happy about in life, great. But I'm not going to force this as a full-time thing. I also didn't necessarily think as a pragmatic mathematician that it would be the most sustainable long term as more would come around, and don't want to rely on my full income on this. So I said, no, I'll work in corporate. Yes, I'll be in an office job. Yes, I'll probably earn way less, and I'll probably slow my growth of social media because I won't have time to create in content, and that wouldn't be my full-time gig. It was okay. And I actually thought, actually, as a smart way, I'm actually one of the first to say I'm leaving that and working in a company. And I was one of the first employees at SDA and even at Duo that had a following. So that even for them, they were like, this is new to us. We don't know what someone with 100,000 followers in a company, that's also a risk. So, you know, it was an interesting career move, but I think at that time, a smart one, and one I wouldn't take back, because I'm not someone who needs to have 1 million followers to be happy. I just want to, I'd rather just do my thing, make a difference. But as a business person, I rather hit my business has 1 million followers than myself.
That makes sense. After going your 6 months internship from Burberry, then going back to complete your studies, were you planning to say, hey, I had a taste of Burberry, I like what they're doing, I want to go back to Burberry to do this full time and try to set that thing up again? Or what was the next step?
So, I mean, Burberry was definitely one of the companies I was really toying about going back because I loved working there. Amazing company policy. You have like free lunch. really great discount. It's like, it was such a good company ethic and the people on the team were so nice. I think I realized if I went back, I would be really junior. And because I came in as an intern just not long ago, right? A year. Yeah. So, I mean, I wasn't expecting to like come my first job after uni at 21, like to be like a manager or something, but I expected a little bit like, you know, I want to have a bit of a step up from an intern. And I did open my horizons to other companies. I had a little stint like 1 month in Paris at like Estée Dupont because it was a bit hard to find a job straight after uni. And I had to really like change my mindset because there was a moment where I was kind of going back to that old ways of listening to my friends in the community. And I applied to Goldman Sachs and all these companies. And I was like, oh, I had some interviews. And I was like, no, this is not my path. Cash, like you learned your lesson, stop going back to your ways, and everyone can go to finance or this and that. Like I need to continue the path that makes me happy or what I knew I would be happy in. And that was working in these kind of beauty fashion brands and working digital marketing because I loved it. So I got an unpaid kind of, it was an intern role, but it was mainly because it was really hard at that time to get a job as an engineer fresh out of uni without many connections into a different company. And I said, okay, either I can go back probably as an intern in Burberry because that's what they were kind of offering me, or I could like go to be an intern in Estée Lauder. I said, at this point, it's just a stepping stone, but let's go to Estée Lauder because it's a different experience. So I went there. Mm-hmm. And then within 2 months, I think the team, I was in working in a company called Aveda and the team were amazing. And they were actually hiring a social media manager role. So I was in the e-commerce team as an intern. And then people were looking at it. And then someone said to me, my colleague Lisa, she said, by the way, and she was a digital manager at the time. She said, you know, you got your own social media account. Like, why don't you apply for this role? You could be really good. Like, it's a manager role. I don't know, you know, but technically you've been on social media for like 6-7 years. You know, got experience. I said, you know what? You're right. So I, at that time, as a typical, as I said, like a study holic, I did 100-page like document for my interview of like why I should be a social media manager and like what I could do with the company, whole audit. And I think, I know, I did my interview, left it there. And I think they were like, okay, this guy's already here. He does have a lot of following. He was really prepared and he has really good ideas. But yes, he's 21. It's a risk because that would be the youngest ever manager ever. But I was pretty like strict. I was like, look, you're not going to change the title because it's unfair. You know, like I have a lot of experience. Age is not something that I think should be so linked to a social media manager role because it's social media. It's not like a typical manager role where it's about having 5-10 years experience managing a team. I'm managing a social account. It's like, you know, it's okay. I got them. Don't worry. So they gave me the role. And yeah, I was the youngest ever manager at Estée Lauder at 21. Well, globally, I'm pretty sure that's what I heard unofficially. And that was where my career started. I think, you know, when you get a good role, good title, even salary at a young age, it really does kickstart your career because when you go to the next thing, you only go above and beyond.
How excited were you when you got the call that or the email that you got it?
I was so excited, but I think it was, I heard about it in the company because I was obviously working there still. So I think I was really happy. I think I noticed. So you know what? It's very interesting. I was so happy, but then you notice how quickly when you work in these companies and people who work in this kind of corporate environment relate, happiness is quite short-lived because you have to go straight into the work, et cetera. But then also there's a lot of politics. So like straight away, it was like, I signed the contract and it's like, oh, could you like change your title? Because, you know, there's a lot of people not happy that you're a manager and they're not a manager yet. And they've been here for 7 years. And I get it. Like, totally. Like if I was there for like 15 years and I was always fighting for a manager title and then I never got it. And then some kid came in as an intern unpaid in e-commerce and suddenly he's a manager within 2 months, you think that's like favoritism or this is unfair. But to my defense, I had to stand up for myself and also for maybe potential future people out there in a similar role to say, A, comparison is always going to happen. It cannot be done in companies. It should be focused on your individual self. Secondly, like there is not always sticks and stones. Like manager for social media is so different to manager in marketing. It's a different manager role. I'm managing accounts, not people. And third, you know, I signed a contract. That's it. You know, I can't change it. So I kept the title. It was all good. But, you know, it was a good experience to be like, whoa, not everyone's happy for me. And that set me up super well for my later career at Dior, et cetera, where politics obviously just increased. And it made me a lot stronger, thicker skinned at a young age. But also to not be upset by these things, because I have to always remember these are not the people. Half the people in my career who said mean things, who sabotaged me or whatever, it's then they get caught up in the company culture. They felt threatened, and maybe rightly so. Maybe I was a threat. Maybe I was difficult or whatever. The point was, is it's not them as an individual. It's the company. It's the work. So I just kind of learned now, like, never take it to personal to heart, unless they're really attacking you as a person. If it's just something to do with the company, it allowed me to really stay strong in these roles at a young age, because otherwise it would be very easy for someone like me to quit straight away and be like, I don't have time for this. Yeah.
So you were 21 when you worked at Estee Lauder. So it was 2 months in, then you got this role. That how long were you working at Estee Lauder, and what was some of the big things that you learned during that time?
So it was one of the best experiences. Obviously it was my first job. I was initially looking after UK market, and then I think they liked what I did. So I looked after EMEA market. So I was working like 2 days a week in EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East, Africa, and then 3 days a week in UK. And when I say that, I mean, like, it was like two different floors. So I just went up and down to different desks, but then I got to travel a lot. So I got to learn very quickly about work trips, and I started kind of upscaling the salon, the staff, the area managers on digital, plus obviously growing the social media accounts. And I learned a hell of a lot. Obviously now I have a hair care brand, so it's also subconsciously amazing because I learned a lot about Ayurvedic hair with Aveda. And I also learned very quickly how you don't have to necessarily work in a company that you initially would have been your dream job. Like, it wasn't my dream job to work in a hair company straight after university. It would have been to work at, maybe if it was in the industry, like maybe a Chanel or Dior, not necessarily that. But it's crazy how quickly you learn to love the brand and the products, and then you realize, well, hair is amazing. This is exactly, you know, this is exactly what I can see myself doing for many years. So I think anyone listening, like, starting in a job that maybe it's not your, you know, especially when you're doing a LinkedIn job applications, and it might be like, oh, okay, interesting, it's not my first choice working for diapers, but actually, could it be interesting? Like, you can find a lot of transferable things. Like, at the end of the day, it's just a product, but your job can still be selling diapers as well as you sell Dior handbags. It could be the same thing, just as long as you be creative with it. And often in these companies, you have a little bit more kind of flexibility and kind of playroom. So I was very glad to work in this company. I was working in local and regional, so for me, it was great to learn local regional mindsets. But it was a year later, not looking at all to move job. And it was my dad met, I believe it was a CFO at Dior at an event or something. And then my dad is my biggest like cheerleader. And I think he just subconsciously said, like, by the way, my son, he's an influencer kind of working in Estee Lauder, doing a lot of, at that time I had a lot of great wins in Estee Lauder, which I think allowed me to grow and get my name out, because I was turning on a lot of things, opening up new accounts, making sales and growth with social media, which wasn't really turned on before. So I think, he said, like, he's doing a good job. And then I think it was like a passing comment of like, oh, he should meet our CEO. I think we need some help on influencers, or we're doing something with this. And then I think a few days later, I got an email from the CEO's assistant being like, are you free to come to Paris to meet Claude? And I said, and I got this email. I was like, oh, okay, this is actually a thing. So I took like a day off, and then I went to Paris while I was still at Estee. Not thinking about leaving. And I didn't realize how big, obviously, the CEO is. I just, in my kind of naivety, but also not someone who really cares about these things and hierarchy, I just went in very chilled, very like conversational. And he was saying like some strategies, and I was like, that's wrong, that doesn't make sense. And oh, we should be doing micro influencers and nano influencers at Dior. Like, that's just a lost opportunity. Like, you shouldn't be like, Dior shouldn't just be like prestige and the top tier, because you can't, you know, there are also micro influencers or small communities that have the purchasing power that can buy all the products, and you're just like completely isolating them. Like, I just did a lot of things. I said, what? And I also came prepared, as I always am, with a deck of what Dior could do better, the engagement rates, the counts, the missed opportunities, the lack of content. I did some benchmarking with other brands similar, YSL, Gucci, like beauty and everything. And I left. I always do that. I leave that with them. So no matter what, how the interview go, they have something to like stay on the desk, beautifully binded, and they might just roll over that. And then it also shows like my professionality, right? So I left that, not thinking anything of it. And then after like a few days, he was like, you know, you need to work with us. We'll make a role. We'll figure it out. You want, and this is in the global office in Paris. When are you free to move to Paris? And do you want a job? And I was like, okay, hang on. This is like a whole new thing. I wasn't expecting to leave. Obviously then crafted an amazing deal contract with the HR. And then I said, okay, this is looking good. Now the last thing to do is to quit. So I quit. It was really hard. I have this issue. Whenever I quit, I like cry because I love the companies I work with. So it's like, I get very emotional because I just love working in my companies. It was really hard. But then I realized I didn't want to leave so quickly and not finish my job. But I also wanted to start super soon with Dior. So I literally did the worst thing for my own kind of health. I quit and then I left with my notice period on a Friday. I had to then move to Paris, move all my stuff. I luckily found like an apartment to stay in, crash in my dad's friend's apartment until like I found my own place. But it, you know, that was also something to think about. And started work on a Monday. So in the weekend, I had to figure out the move, the lorry, and then set up my bank because you have to have a bank. You have to have this like national social security. And then France is not the easiest. It's not like everything's online. Everything's like in person. So when you get there, you got to like do everything in person, like send it to the local town hall, go actually do your health check and fill in these forms by paper first. And it's very like a bit old school, but I realized everything's French. Like there's not one form of English. Like going there as a tourist, you think blindly like, oh yeah, yeah, it's fine. I can live here. When you live there, your contract for your work, your supermarket, the bank, everything's in French. They don't even speak a word of English. So luckily I did 10 years of French in school, but you know, I didn't speak for, I think 7-8 years since I moved then. So I had to take lessons really quickly. So learn a language was another thing to add to the spanner, or, you know, to add to the works of everything. So yep, it was not easy, but I mean, you know, I was freaking working for a Dior Global in Paris. It was worth it at the end of the day.
So was there a bigger jump in your title compared to Estee Lauder? And were you able to negotiate a better contract right away just because you got that role in Estee Lauder as a social media manager leveling up?
So definitely. So title-wise, yes. I guess because, you know, but manager in France is much more, I guess, senior than manager in London. So like, there's a little like, you know, there's only a couple of directors in the head office and that's it. And then there's like, chief officers. So you normally have a chef de projet, which is project manager, and then you have a senior project manager. And then if you're a manager, that's like you've been there for 10 years, you have a big group you're managing. So I came in as a manager. So that way, like I skipped a lot of levels because usually just for you to know, like my age at that time would be the youngest intake of interns because after university, you have something called like prepa usually. So you go to university a bit later, then you have university. And then you have 3 internships of 6 months you got to do usually before you work in corporate. Mm. And then usually then you start working as a CDD or a CDI, and then it's like a chef de projet junior. So to be a manager, you're looking at 35 years old plus as an average age of by the time you've worked in corporate in France. So I started that. So that was a huge career jump, even though like it, for me, it was like, I just said to them, like I was a manager there. I'm not going to be a project manager. I'm going to be a manager or above. So that was my first kind of boom, not accepting anything less. And then my salary obviously increased quite a bit, but it was mainly about the scope of work that I cared about. I don't care about titles. I don't care about salary. I would have given any of that up just for making sure I have a good scope of work where I can learn and grow. So yeah, looking after all the global markets, but I was an earned media manager, which I guess if you know media, it's like earned, paid and owned. But in earned and Dior, PR was in a separate division. So I didn't have the PR organic part. I had all the paid influencer part. But yeah, that was my job. And then obviously I had to craft it out when I got there and keep on bringing new things into my remit because I kept on reinventing and inventing things and wanting to do things. And obviously no one else would do it. And I was like, I can do it. Don't pay me more. Don't give me a title. I'll launch affiliate marketing and I'll launch new social media accounts. So my role at the end was the most confusing things. I ended up being like a global manager, digital manager, and just doing a bit of everything, whatever needed to be done. So I was a bit of this. And that's why a lot of politics happened because I was working on so many touch points that kind of overlap a lot of people. So I never intended. And, you know, obviously I apologize to anyone listening who is from Dior, that would probably like, yeah, you were kind of like doing my role. It's like my job was always just to push Dior further. And I think when I left, I'm friends with everyone at Dior. And I think they all realized when I quit that after 3 years that, oh, he wasn't taking my job. You know, he wasn't here to sabotage me. He was here just to do new things. And, you know, if you really take two steps back, I didn't accept a salary increase. I didn't accept a job title. I just added more stuff to my plate that I first said, anyone else wants to do it? No one else wants to do it? I'll do it. Because I really loved and cared for the brand and I wanted to just grow it. So, yeah, I think people who are in similar situations and in maybe slightly political roles that are, you know, touching on people's remit, you just have to bring them in, make you work together. You know, you can do the work and then you present it together, whatever you need to be, however you need to play the game. But don't stop, you know, growing the company at the expense of people's ego. Like it's right. So important, and your own ego, just like put the company first, because when you, this is your testing ground to whatever you do in the future, whether it's your next job or whether it's if you have your own company, which I guess is everyone's dream, can be quite a lot of people's dream. And it's the best school, like, you know, university is nothing compared to working in for a company. So the more you can do and grow a company, the more when you have your own company, you will just be so much better off.
And when you were working at Estee, were you already dealing with influencer marketing? And was that how you carried that over to Dior and then start building it that way? How did you, you know, coming in as, you know, a new title, a new manager, and you're young, how did you find your footing? How did you know what to do and who to work with? And what was the right steps and make sure that, you know, you weren't stepping on any toes or you weren't messing things up because it was such a big brand?
So yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I was always in digital in both in Estee and Dior. So PR at that time were starting to get influencers in their remit, but it was still very much like coffees with influencers, not necessarily the paid budget with influencers. So I kind of had to always learn from Estee time to work very closely to how to, I guess you could say, work with the different teams together collaboratively and not overlap for the influencer's sake too. Because of course, like if I'm with a team that has a budget that pays, say, micro influencers, but then the PR works the top tier influencers and invites them to events and coffees and lunches, but doesn't have the budget to pay. I don't want a Dior or Estee micro influencer to go to the top influencer because they're friends and be like, "Oh, Dior just paid me X." They might not even say Dior paid me X. They might be like, "Dior just paid me," and then they're like, "I've never been paid by Dior, and I work with them so much, and I do so much for them." And that actually, those situations happened. So a lot of collaboration, a lot of communication. I didn't just do influencers. I did influencers. I did like social media affiliate, and then I did a little bit of a lot of reporting. A lot of like, I did all global reports, both in Estee and Dior. So I think that's what I think. Allowed me to people knew I had my remit, but then the other stuff I got to like just collaboratively work with the different teams. But influencer marketing, the best learnings I got were through my own channels. You know, I wouldn't say I was growing it as a brand influencer, like promoter. I was more of a travel influencer. So when I was going around, I still used to travel while I was at even Dior. I remember getting some viral posts from my travels to like Cappadocia or like whatever. And I often, even with work trips, I often like went 2 days earlier or, you know, on the mornings went out. And I kind of also hopefully inspire a lot of people in the company to be like, when you're traveling around the world. And even my CEO told me the thing that stuck with me was, I'm inspired by your Instagram. So that's what made me continue doing it, is because you go to these places that for work or whatever. And obviously I'm very respectful. Like when I'm there for work, I work. But if I have like from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., I might explore the city and then go back and then work at 8, you know? And I had to post I worked as well, just so people didn't take that as a wrong way and be like, he's going to China for with Dior and he's just traveling around. Like I had to like be, it was hard because obviously being so open on social media as an influencer, people would then sometimes take it wrongly because you only post the best and you're not going to post you working for 8 hours, right?
Of course.
Don't see that.
Of course.
But I had to find that balance. But I did basically inspire him to say, you know, he's been to Singapore, for example, or Hong Kong, or a lot of these places in Asia a lot, because that's where our main markets were with Dior. And I used to go around and take all these amazing photos at places. And he's like, I've never seen these, but I've been there all the time with work. And I said, yeah, like, you know, you should like go a day earlier or wake up a bit early in the morning and you're here for work. Even better, like the company pays, it's awesome. You know, you get to travel a bit more than you would be able to normally because it's expensive to go to these places. but enjoy and see the world and see the country, because you're also going to get, not only would it help the job because you're getting a lot more absorption of the culture and the community, so you can do your job better in that country and understand the market better. Two, it makes your experience in the company better. You're probably less likely to quit because you're happier, you've seen more. And three, you don't have to travel as much because you've seen a bit. So when you go back, you're motivated to work. You're not like, I need a holiday after, you know? So I think that importance of work trips, or even just when you're in your own city, like just explore, it helps everything. It doesn't go against it. And I think people often have this ability to be like, it's a work trip. It's not for fun. No, it's like, you can have a bit of fun, but you can also work really hard.
So you went to Dior at, what was it? 23, 24?
Yes, I would say 20. I would say 23. Yeah, 23.
Yeah. And the average age of a manager would be any sort of at least 35 plus.
Yeah, I mean, I will say one thing. When I say that, that's like a very average level. It can be younger, older, but I take my words back a bit. Like, I was the master of like, never mention my age. Like, my main rule when I came to Dior was like, if my age is mentioned, I quit. So like, I would say, like, in the same time, like, yeah, age is nothing, honestly, it's nothing but a number in a company. And now it's completely disrupted. Maybe I was one of the first to maybe disrupt it a bit, but like, now I'm seeing like colleagues of mine, like who are a lot more senior, get director titles now finally. So there's a lot of the industry is catching up. I think the small businesses and the startups that are having, like, you know, 25-year-old COOs and stuff are changing the giants of today, because they're understanding that you need to like retain talent, and sometimes talent needs quicker career growth. It's not like you have to be 3 years in a job to prove yourself. It could be even 6 months to a year. And then if they're that good and you their risk of leaving, you got to listen and do what they want to make them stay. Otherwise they will leave. And Dior had a lot of this, and a lot of companies at the time had a lot of like people leaving quickly because they couldn't adapt to retaining the talent. So yeah, at that time I was definitely way the youngest, but now it's kind of all shifted, I would say.
So how were you able to, what are some of the lessons that you learned in order to deal with company politics and also to effectively communicate with your colleagues?
I think it was definitely feeding kindness back to whenever I heard negativity, because there was two routes. If ever I had some potential conflict, I could either play the game and never be friends, or I could just be, oh, I'm so young, I'm naive, I made a mistake, you know, playing my age then to my advantage, and then basically say, look, sigh, yes, this is annoying, but let me just learn to understand and love this person, and hopefully they'll end up coming around to me. And often it did work, and then ended up actually organically, I was like, oh, actually, no, you're really cool. And then that initial, like, let me just try, ended up to, no, I don't need to try. Like, actually, I'm really glad I tried, because it was a misunderstanding, it was a miscommunication. So that was one thing, but definitely, I think that the most important thing was staying as friendly as possible, especially with my team, who were often even older than me. I had to, like, you know, not be condescending and rude. I had to be like, you know, we're the same age, you know, we're in it together. Terminology, saying like we, sometimes like bringing the right people in the room. Like, sometimes my intern, I said, you send the email to the CEO, and she's like, no, I can never. I said, no, you did the work, you should send it, you know, like empowering and giving the respect to when it's where it's due. And also just really listening more than speaking was also really important, and knowing when's the right time to speak up and when's the right time to just shut up. So I learned this all through making mistakes. So I wasn't really good at it at the beginning, to be honest. Like, all these learnings is like, now 3 years later after working in Dior, I can now say like I became very good at it. But you're meant to make mistakes, and it's okay as long as you're not making them again and again and again. So do listen. And if you are, you know, I didn't learn straight away. Like, I had to keep when I had, okay, now I'm having a problem with this person. Now I'm having a problem with this person. Maybe it's me. Maybe I need to change. And I think that was really important, to just, listen, and even your own actions and people around you. And always, always, always put yourself in their shoe. Because even though I don't like how they act, or I don't know why they're not, Or I, even in the other end, if I'm wondering why are they so nice to me, you know, and then I thought, is it maybe they need me to help them in their business? So I need to help them, you know, or maybe they're using me stay away, be careful, you know, a lot of things you have to understand. Yeah.
So when I met you, I think you were already in Dior. Then how long after did you decide to say, hey, I want to do my own thing. I want to potentially, you know, leave this job that I was excelling in. I was one of the youngest. I was doing this. We were hitting targets. We're doing bigger and better things. What made you have that deciding factor?
So I think I always knew from a young age I wanted to have my own business. I mean, I definitely wanted to take over my dad's businesses, which is in the beauty industry as well. That's why beauty was such a natural kind of, I guess you could say, like, journey for me. I think for me it was, I always was an entrepreneur in these companies. So entrepreneur, like an inside entrepreneur. And I always knew my time was fleeted, which is why I said, either I jump and stepping stone to different companies, because I feel like I could learn exactly what I did in 2 years. But it wouldn't necessarily be like a time thing, but if I stopped learning, then I would leave. And, you know, in that time in these companies, it was like, they're not going to promote you to a new role, a new division every 2 years, every year. Like, there is a kind of like, you know, after 3-4 years, we can discuss. And sometimes I was like, it's like going to university and doing the same course for the same year. Like, why would I repeat the year 3-4 times? Like, no, you would want to graduate to the next year, do something next. So a year at Estee and then 3 years at Dior was actually the perfect time, because I got to do a lot in those 3 years and grow. And that's why I kept on wanting to bring new things into my remit. But it was the second to third year where I started realizing I'm doing the same thing and I can't do influencers and affiliate and this forever. I wanted to learn about finance or about sales or trade marketing. And obviously it wouldn't be like the easiest transition in a big company to be like, okay, I was head of influencers. Now I want to be head of finance. Like, can you move me? They'll be like, no, you're not skilled and there's already a team there. So I knew I had to like think about something outside, but it wasn't necessarily about going to another company, because I was already at that time in my mind, one of the top companies of the world, Dior, like it's the dream. And as I said, as you said, I had a very good career path within LVMH that I could have just stayed within. My sister came to me, I think it was in my second year of Dior, and she was like, I have this idea. It was just a hair oil, kind of beard oil idea. And I said, oh, let's try. Love this kind of concept. And I said, let's, and then we kind of said, let's do it together, because it was really our childhood memories growing up. It was our story with our grandma, Ayurveda. And we were like, yeah, there is no hair oil Ayurvedic hair care brand really in the market when we talk about Sephora, et cetera. I worked at Aveda, which was an Ayurvedic brand that went a little bit off tangent into like different areas, wasn't so Ayurvedic, but it wasn't in the likes of Sephora US. You know, it wasn't this indie brand. It was very salon centric. And we were like, oh, there's a gap in the market. Yes. We had this incredible name, kind of idea of Faber and Main, because it was like the stories of our grandma reading them at night while massaging these Ayurvedic herbs and oils into our hair. The story and hair rituals, Faber and Main. And we had this concept of brand book, and we just linked and messaged a Sephora merchant. And then they actually were like, oh, this is really interesting. Could you come into San Francisco and pitch it to us? So we went, during one of my holidays, went there. When I was at Dior, and I was like, okay, let's see. They came back, said, okay, come back again with a wider team. Like, we love this, but bring some samples this time. So we had no samples. It was just a concept. We then went to some labs, got some samples, but this is all while I was at Dior. So I was like on the side, I was working in like 2 hours at night, but my sister was also working mainly full-time on this. So that's why it moved quicker. And then, yeah, like when Sephora was like, we want to launch with you in store and online in a few months or whenever we're ready. I said, wow, this is actually a brand. It's my brand with my sister. Well, nothing's better than that for me, because I love my sister. Then it's guaranteed one of the biggest retailers in the world. And I think this is an opportunity I have to focus on, and I can't not. But in my silly time, I was like, oh, no, I can do both. I'm doing both. Let's do it. Because I loved working at Dior. And it was my sister one day. It was like 4 or 5 months before it was in my summer holiday when we were in America with the labs finalizing things.
Production. And when was this? Just to make sure that we know.
This was in 2019. Bearing in mind, so just from a, this is my third year at Dior, 2019. I quit, and this is in August. I quit in November, just for you to know. And then I launched Faber & Main in April 2020. So this was like quite a quick, less than a year kind of turnaround. My sister cried in the car, and she was like, you need to quit Dior. You need to be the CEO. You need to take this over. I can create the products. I can't build the team. I can't build a brand. I can't build a business. I need you, but I need you fully. And it's not fair that you're you know, definitely giving a lot more to Dior. And I was like, no, you're right. But I tried to quit so many times before that, and my company, Dior and stuff didn't really let me. So I just had to, like, I said, no, I'm doing this for my sister. I went back, went straight to HR, because I said, that's easier if I go to HR than my boss, and my CEO. I quit. And I said, this is it. This is the decision. Did my 2-3 months probation, 2-3 months, kind of, I forgot the word, but you know, when you have your
transition. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, notice period. And then basically I left, and it was hard because everyone was upset, blah, blah, blah. But then when I told them, you know, I'm creating a brand, it's guaranteed at Sephora, they understood, no, this is amazing. And they were happy for me and never looked back. And thank God, one of my teammates, my colleague, my person for my team, Estelle, she joined me to London to start my venture, which was the most humbling thing, to leave Dior and work for me. And then from her, we grew the team in the last 2 years, and we launched in April last year. It's been a year and a half, and what a journey it's been.
So what are some of the challenges, you know, from going from, you know, the concept of starting something with, you know, family, even doing business with family sometimes is challenging, let alone your sister, and then deciding on, you know, acting on it, and then registering a company, making sure that everything is set up properly, and managing that. What are some of the challenges you had to face, and how did you overcome some of those challenges?
I think, like, the biggest challenge for me was launching in the pandemic, number one, not knowing, you know, it wasn't intended for that. We were meant to have an in-store online launch. We had a lot of plans for in-store activity. And we literally, you know, we plan launches 6 months to 8 months before we do anything. So bearing in mind, the pandemic happened last year. We launched April, May, which was exactly the beginning of lockdown. So we launched the prime time of this whole thing. Blessing in disguise, because we didn't have any historical launch. So in a way, we could adapt to be purely digital, agile. You know, it was fine. It wasn't the worst case. But at the time, it was scary because we didn't know how long it would last. We didn't know where to invest in. But everything started to be very different. Like, our production was like a lot more slower. People, they were saying, oh, because of the pandemic, the shipping rates were 4 times more. So my cash flow had to get a big, you know, it wasn't like, it was like $10,000 to send the products of my case of cartons, not like 3,000, which is what I kind of budgeted for. You know, everything changed and I had no choice but to pay these things and to wait for the delays. But in a way, again, as I said, it was my starting experience in this. So at least I started in the deep end, then in the shallow end, and then quickly in the deep end. So that was good. That was a real big challenge. And then hiring remotely, everyone working from home, building the team without seeing them, not having an office, not being able to travel, not going to visit my lab, my production, which all happens in America. I'm based in London. Not seeing my products in store at launch, not having the ability to do photo shoots really with models and, you know, video shoots, having to send products and just rely on people doing them at home. It was really tough because it wasn't the plan I initially had. But then what made it easier was everyone went through the same thing. So there was a sense of, this is okay. And then the business thrived a bit because, you know, salons were closing. Everything was online. And what do I know best? Online. What do I do for my whole career? 5 years? Digital influencers, social selling, affiliate marketing. So turning all of those on, in a way, made our brand swim so fast and really, like, became a brand that was be able to open up in a lot more retail, a lot more doors. And people to this day always say, like, oh, you guys have been around for like 5 years, 6 years. I'm like, no, we just launched like literally a year ago. And that's pretty cool to make people have seen it now. I think at one point we've been viral on TikTok quite a few times. And that is just pretty amazing. That's the power of digital and social media. And
did you and your sister bootstrap the entire company, or was it because you guys already know with the concept that Sephora was going to give you a big purchase order and say, hey, then now we're in business? Or how did you guys go by, you know, funding it, getting people on board, hiring people?
So to be really honest, it's completely bootstrapped, completely family funded, and it's still to this day. We're quite fortunate, of course, having our father, where we can have access to some cash that most people would need to obviously raise and dilute. And for us, of course, that's something we'll need to do as the business grows. It's going to be only a certain amount my dad can and continue to invest in. And that's something, you know, we're going to look into soon. But for now, for the first 2 years, I think, you know, I definitely had a lot of industry experts telling us like what you would need, and you never get told that. But I think I learned quite quickly when you have a growing business, a viral business, you need a lot more than you think, just to kind of facilitate the production inventory, because that's the biggest part. So our A&P, our media, has been quite humble and small. It's been mainly production and sampling. And when you launch with a retailer, you have to like invest in, especially a big beast like Sephora, you know, you don't have to, but there'll be a lot of co-ops, things you do together, a lot of like partnership marketing, a lot of sampling. They might say, you have an amazing opportunity for the brand, but we need 50,000 sachets. And that's at our cost. And that's like probably like $50,000 of cash flow I need just to do $1 sample each, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of these costs you need to know. And, you know, I'm building very soon I'll be launching a how to build a brand in a year course, where I'll be sharing like all of this, the numbers you need, the amount of money you really need, your business planning, your financial planning, to make it easier for people to actually know, because not many people tell you. But in a nutshell, I will say it was something that we had to keep on going back and say, we need more, because we never planned for enough. But we definitely were, while we weren't profitable by the end, we were profitable at every stage. We put the money back in. Me and my sister don't really take a salary. You know, everything is done very smartly and carefully to make the business first. And I think that's super important to start with. But to your point, just to kind of finish that, is the purchase orders with Sephora and retailers, and this is the big myth, is it's not big day one. Like it's like insulting. Usually like most brands would be like insulted by the first PO, but it's weekly replenishment. So they order on a weekly basis, these retailers usually, sometimes monthly, but usually weekly. So if you sell out, they'd rather you sell out and then you're being out for a bit, and then they know that, and then they'll go like this. So they might only order 50 to 100 units of each SKU at the beginning. They don't want to take the risk. And then you're like, what? That's so small. And then it can go up to like 5,000 if you sell out, you know? So it can go quickly up. It's just about understanding that, like, don't be off put by your first PO by your retailer, but use that as a motivation to sell more, and then to buy, for them to buy more. Yeah.
And that when you were starting to hire for your own team, how did you know how to find good talent, how to hire the right talent? And was that strictly because of your time at Estée, at Dior, that you learned what talent was like, how you bring in the right type of people, or were you just kind of half winging it?
So it was definitely, I think I did pride myself when I was at Dior that I know very well, like how to manage modern talent, like new age talent, because it needs a lot more nurturing, a lot more listening, a lot more reactivity, a lot of kind of career opportunity and growth prospects. And at the same time as well, it needs a little bit of trust and risk, because I believe a lot more, like my way of hiring is first hire an army of doers, talented people who not necessarily might have the skill set or have the experience, but could learn quickly in the job, be amendable, adaptable, and then excel and be hungry to work no matter what. And I think that's what I was like. Right? I did engineering and they took a risk on me to do social media and I excelled. So I did the same thing. So I hired a lot of people that had no skill sets in their job, but I made them like, you're going to be doing this, you're going to be doing that. But I said, if you want to change, we can move you around. But let's first introduce you to everything, see what you like. But I think you'll be good at this. So my brand manager today, who will be the GM, and she's amazing. She was with me at Dior as first my intern, then my like chef de cuisine junior. And now she's like running the ship. Without Estelle, we wouldn't be able to do anything with Fable & Main. She does everything 360. And she's like the best GM in the world to me. I wouldn't hire anyone from my previous companies except her. And she became that in 3 years. So managing a team needs that risk. You do need to, like, obviously during the pandemic, do just Zoom calls and then just, you know, listen, ask them like, how do they like working? Do they want to eventually have an office? Do they want to stay working at home? Because, you know, those decisions, they might want to stay working at home forever. So just being clear on like their future. But I have a one rule, and I always say this, and I think it really helps retain talent, but also trust in my team. When I hire everyone, I say, you know, this is just a trampoline to your better future. Now, if you want to stay on this trampoline for as long as you want, that's amazing, because I'll make it worth your time. You'll grow with me. But at the same time, if you, after 6 months, a year, want to move to the next thing, as long as you communicate with me, because to know that I will help you, I will push you with you, I want you to go to the next big thing, this is, you know, no hard feelings. You can leave after 6 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years. But I want you to be the best next job. So even if you tell me, look, Akash, I am a bit bored. I don't know if this is for me, but can you help me get another job? I will help you, you know, but communicate, because maybe there's a role here, maybe there's a role somewhere else, but I don't want you to ever feel like you're not learning and growing at any point of your career with me. And I think that's something, I think that's really helped retain a lot of my employees. It's been good.
I know we've got to wrap up soon, but I want to quickly touch upon, you know, the agency that you also founded on the side of doing everything that you're currently doing. Tell me a little bit about what that agency is like. Why did you found it? How has it been? And what's going on?
It was a bit of an accidental, again, like, as I said, always, blessing. When I left Dior, they wanted me to continue consulting with them. So then I naturally had to like create an entity to consult and work with them. I also still run their affiliate program because no one could really do it when I left. So I still work with them as an agency. And then I started to get a few other clients from friends who went to, from Dior, who went to other companies, said, oh, you have to work with Akash. He's got his now, his little agency. So I started getting L'Oreal and then Puig and some big brands. And now my agency is like, you know, nearly 13 employees. It's growing every day. I have great directors who kind of run the ship. I just bring the clients and then they kind of take it over. It was initially called a cash agency, so it was more of a consulting agency. Then I quickly changed that because everyone wanted a cash in the call, and I was like, I don't have time to be on every single call. Like, you know, you have an amazing team there. That's okay. So I kind of changed the name to Kawanu, which stands for like content, commerce, community, and the three C's of marketing. And then Anu is a network unified. So it's connecting them as a triangle. Mm. So the Co-Anu, but I just want to make it like a fun name that no one really knows what it means. And I also switched from having a lot of clients, whether it was like Relais Chateau and hotels, to I had all types of clients, to now just beauty. So we're really a beauty focused and wellness focused agency, doing influencer marketing, social media, bit of consulting, bit of everything, 360. We do sampling, reviews, whatever you need, even content. But I have to be honest, like as much as it's growing and it's a big priority of mine to make it a success for my clients, my main baby is always Fable & Main as my brand. I've got nearly 40 employees in all my businesses I own. So it's growing every day. And as much as I need to, you know, be involved with everything, I have to delegate and rely on my teams to take it to the next level, because it's their babies as well as it's mine. So it's a weird feeling to, like, you know, I work a lot. I don't work as hard as I did in my mind, because I'm not every day doing a lot. I'm not presentation building and, you know, doing a lot of, like, I guess you could say building, but what I'm doing is a hell of a lot of calls. That's pretty much, I'm like my dad now. All I do is calls, one after one, and I delegate. But I think that's a point at your career at any age where you start realizing, okay, I can't manage 40 people. I can't manage 4 businesses. I can't, you know, do all of that. I will become a bottleneck in all of them if I don't delegate and rely. So I'm more of a puppeteer now and keep on building the companies and the ideas, but I'm no longer the doer, which is great. It's the sad thing is I'm not learning as much because I'm not involved as much in everything, but it's okay because I'm getting the joy from my team learning.
As an entrepreneur, do you find it difficult delegating? So I speak with a lot of different entrepreneurs, and obviously everything we touch is our babies, right? Everything we need to do, we love it. We want every aspect of it. No, this font is not right. No, that the client won't be happy with this. We need to change it. And there's this big trust factor that you need to have when delegating. You have to trust them to make sure that they are able to execute to a level that you know, is satisfactory for everyone. Do you find it difficult in order to delegate?
I did find it first hard, because especially when it's your company, you get a bit of that control freak of like, oh, I could do it a bit better, or send it to me, that's fine, and I'll change the whole thing, you know. I think you have to realize there is a point where the better way to do that is, instead of doing it, educate them and make them learn your way or the way of the company, and then they'll start getting better. And once you start doing that first, the delegation becomes a lot easier, because then the delegation turns from I don't know if I should just do it. It's quicker if I do it. I don't want to give it away, to, that person can probably do it quicker and better, and I don't really have the time, so let's rely on Estelle to do the presentation. And now I've got to a point where Estelle's presentations are better than my presentations, you know? So I think delegation can be the most empowering thing. Once you set up the ground rules and you know, you have some processes in place, you have some training in place, you have to make it get to a place where you're happy and you feel confident in delegating. Don't just delegate when you're not happy and, it's really bad, but let me still send it. Because no, you shouldn't settle for that. And you will never be happier then, you know, but there is some processes to put in place. And once you've done that, delegation is the best asset ever. Because at the end of the day, that's the only way you can grow and grow and grow, is when you master delegation.
My last question is, if you were to be stripped away of all of your money, resources, and network today, and you had to start all over again tomorrow, what are the first three things you would do and why?
So one question I have to, just before I answer that, do I have my memory still of the last business?
Yes.
Okay. I think if I were to do that, I would pretty much, it sounds bad, but I think working for such a long time, building at a young age, I'm just building now out of I'm just in that drive mode, because I'm trying to earn a lot of money to do my greater purpose, which is give back to wildlife. If today I lost everything, I don't think I would have the full energy to start again, because I've just done it. So I would probably say, cool, I'll go then to more. I wanted to make a lot of money so I can make a big impact in wildlife and in tigers and big cats and animals around the world. But I know there's a lot of value in time as well, and giving your time and even fundraising, whatever. So then I think at that point, I would say I would just move to Africa, or probably Africa, be with the wildlife, volunteer my time, and then travel around the world with my network to have other people's money to make a difference. Because then I realized I couldn't do it myself. So let me just get others. But that's just the reality of, you need to have money to make a big impact with animals. Everything, I'm working so much with local organizations, and every time they come to me, it's like, we need to save this cheetah, but we need $20,000 for a cheetah collar. And I'm like, it's so expensive, everything. But that's where I found my passion. So I'm going to go every December. I go to Africa, it's my reset. And that's what I would do. So I know that's not three things, but I think that summarizes what I would do next.
Akash, buddy, I appreciate you being on the show. For the people that want to follow you or keep up with what you're doing, where is the best place to find you?
So my Instagram is at meta_A, not the new Facebook meta, but it's M-E-H-T-A.
You do have to explain that nowadays.
You have to explain meta_A. So, or type in Akash Meta, A-K-A-S-H-M-E-H-T-A. And Fable and Maine, my baby is Fable and Maine. And those are the two things I would say if you want to follow.
I'll make sure you're tagged in everything so you don't have to worry. Amazing. Akash, I appreciate being on the show, buddy.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
And thank you so much. Me.